Welcome to the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, presented by the Hampton Inn Waco. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast. I'm Jackson Michael. The Texas Sports Hall of Fame hosted its second Lone Star Luncheon in May of 2023. The luncheon featured Major League Baseball pitching icon Roger Clemens. Attendees enjoyed a delicious steak lunch and a wonderful storytelling session with Roger Clemens, moderated by former Houston Astros announcer Bill Brown. This episode will put you tableside with some highlights from the luncheon. Remember that you can attend future Lone Star Luncheons at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. Follow the Texas Sports Hall of Fame on its social media channels on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and visit the Texas Sports Hall of Fame's official website, tshof.org, to learn how you can attend the next Lone Star Luncheon and keep up with all of the fantastic events happening at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. You can also listen to highlights of the Lone Star Luncheon with golf legend Lee Trevino in episode 47 of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast. If you enjoy the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, please remember to like, review, and share the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Roger Clemens attended Springwoods High School in the Houston area. Clemens' road to the major leagues included pitching in junior college before playing for the great Cliff Gustavson at the University of Texas. You can listen to Roger Clemens share stories about his Longhorn career and hear Coach Gustavson discuss his life and career in episode 3 of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast. Roger Clemens was drafted by the Boston Red Sox in the first round of the 1983 amateur draft. He went on to win 7 Cy Young Awards, the most of any pitcher in history. He also had 20 strikeouts in a game 2 times, also unmatched in Major League Baseball history. He won 2 World Series as a member of the New York Yankees, and also pitched in the World Series for the Boston Red Sox and the Houston Astros. Roger Clemens also pitched for the Toronto Blue Jays. He was inducted into the Texas Sports Hall of Fame in 1998. Former Astros announcer Bill Brown started the discussion by asking about Clemens' early years.
Pick up the story then with how you really got immersed in this sport.
Yeah, so the story is, I mean, it's well told. My pops passed away when I was 9, and I was raised by 2 strong-willed ladies, my mother and my grandmother. The way we ended up in Texas, my brother got stationed at Fort Hood, and he since passed. He served in Vietnam. Jumping on that subject, I have 5 uncles that served. If anybody in this room has served or have someone that served, I tip my cap to you forever. It's so important. My mom worked 3 jobs in Houston. She was an accountant by day. I helped her stock coolers in the afternoon, and we cleaned some warehouse built office buildings at night. I had a sweet red glove and a brand new pair of cleats, so I thought we were rich. But mom, you know, she grinded it out and took me to my games, dropped me off to practices. I'll never forget, you know, where you come from. Deb and I still live in Houston, 7 miles from my high school.
And then college, San Jack.
Yeah.
Wayne Graham.
Yes. So, Billy, when you bring that up, it makes me think about growing up. I had 3 wonderful coaches. They were all great coaches, better teachers of the game and the game of life for me. Charlie Mariano since passed at Springwoods High School. Charlie, coach, could have probably got a NCAA job anywhere in the country to quadruple his pay. He had to stay close to home because Sandy, his wife, was the longest living with CF. And so she was right there, and she was the coach's, ultimate coach's wife. When he would get on us too hard, we'd go to her and complain to her, and she would air him out and tell him to back off. And but coach was like my father figure. I didn't have a car in high school, so we lived, our house was about 3 miles from school, so I had to walk back on after practice and jog back to the house or whatever. Then I played for Coach Wayne Graham. Everybody knows that name in this room. Coach, another baseball lifer. I consider him right next to like a Don Zimmer, our bench coach. Zim never cashed a check outside of Major League Baseball. But Coach Graham, baseball man through and through. I matured with his program. I grew a little bit. And then Coach Gus came calling, winning his coach in NCAA baseball at the time. And he never really raised his voice. It was like that old commercial way back when, you know, when EF talks, people listen. That's the way it was with Coach Gus. When he said something, you took note. And it was great going, lost in 82 in the World Series. I think tied for third, maybe in Miami. Came back the next year and beat Alabama. And then that's kind of when my life changed a little bit, going, getting drafted by the Red Sox and going on professional.
There's the ring.
There it is. Yeah, I wear this. I wear my national championship ring more than I wear my World Series.
Clemens next spoke about his breakthrough 1986 season with the Red Sox and how teammate Bruce Hurst gave him the nickname The Rocket. He also shared memories of striking out 20 batters in a single game. Still a major league record. He even gave some background about being drafted by the Red Sox after Texas had won the College World Series.
Rangers had number one pick, the Astros had the third pick, and we kept seeing the scouts, so I kind of think, you know, was thinking that, hey, I'm going to, you know, stay close to home, get drafted by one of these guys. The only other one that we knew was the Los Angeles Dodgers had the 18th pick, and they had said they were going to take me, but I went right before that to Boston. I was like, I didn't even know where Boston was. I was like, what? And my mom, being a historian like she wrote me a couple nice poems about Fenway Park, so I get drafted, go through the minor league pretty quick, gonna go home to relax, and the Red Sox said, no, you're coming to Fenway, we wanna show you around, do some things, blah, blah, blah. It was a really cool game, because I think the Red Sox were playing Baltimore, and I think Dennis Eckersley was facing Jim Palmer when I was there, so it was a pretty good matchup for me to see. But the funny thing is when I came from the airport, you know, I don't think there's cell phones, you know, whatever. If there were, there was a big shoe looking and so I had my head in the paper. Next thing you know, the cab driver parks, stops, says, here you go, kid. And I look out the window, and I just see a brick building. I thought it was a warehouse. And I go, hey, cabbie, I said, I'm a professional ball player. I'm going to Fenway Park. I'm a Boston Red. He goes, this is it, kid. Get your ass out of my cab. And I get out, and it's still there. And the Red Sox guys meet me, and they take me through a tunnel, and then they take me up the ramp by first base, and I see nothing but green grass and the big green monster. And you know, that's the tradition there was unlike anything else to be able to play with a, you know, wonderful, historic team like the Boston Red Sox. But the 86 season, Billy was exactly right. I started off 14-0. I think earlier, my fourth win, that's when I struck out 20. And that, you know, Bruce Hurst, my teammate, left-hander, actually just talked to him a couple of days ago. And Hurst, he gave me the nickname The Rocket that night after the game. He whispered on the way out, it was like myself, I was just finished icing my arm, and our pitching coach was there, Bill Fisher. But anyway, Hershey goes, I don't think you understand. He goes, pitching was a second class citizen in this town till you got here. And he goes, you don't realize it, but your life just changed, and our lives as a team just changed. And it didn't really soak in. I didn't even know there was a strikeout, you know, thing going on until they flashed it with the Red Sox team strikeout. And then I found out that Ryan and Seaver and Carlton all had 19 or whatever. But long story longer, I almost missed that game. I got caught in traffic. The Celtics had a playoff game. I was on Storrow Drive, and there was a concert going on, and I was getting ready to run. I could see the Citgo sign about a mile and a half away, and I had boots, jeans, and a golf shirt on or something. I was gonna put my running shoes on and run. But anyway, I got to the park late. They were gonna scratch me. I said, no chance. I'm not gonna answer to the media by missing the start because I was late. So anyway, fast forward, I punch out 20 guys, set a major league record, pitching coach, who Bill Fisher is what you all know. Fish, I went and spoke at his funeral a couple of years ago. Wonderful man. Like I said, he had Tom Seaver in Cincinnati and brought him over to the Red Sox. But Fish, still to this day, I think it's 91 consecutive innings that he did not walk a guy. And Greg Maddux tried to do that. He got to the high 80s and then ended up walking a guy. In the 20 strikeout game, I didn't realize until Fish told me, he's at my locker. He and I were really the only two in the locker room at the time. And he goes, he called me Smokey at the time for Smokey Joe, after Smokey Joe Wood. So he said, Smokey, a couple of things. He goes, unbelievable, he's 20 strikeouts, going that high rate of speed. He goes, but your control, you didn't walk a single guy. That's what I'm most proud of. I said, I didn't realize that, but it's just really cool. Well, I almost missed the game, was late, right? He walks off, he takes about four steps, and he comes back. He goes, one more thing, Smokey. He goes, you get to the damn ballpark anytime you want. And I said, no, Chris, I was embarrassed. I'll never let that happen again. So, but and then Fish called me 10 years later. I repeated defeat in Detroit 10 years later. I had a phone call on the phone, and they told me it was Bill Fisher, and Fish had retired. And he goes, Smokey. I go, I didn't walk anybody, Fish. He goes, that's why I'm calling. So he was great. He was a great man. I had great relationships with my pitching coaches.
He was the butt of many jokes in Cincinnati, I'm sure, in Boston. So we were on a flight one time, and we had to wear coats and ties back in that day. And so Seaver went up to him, and they were standing in the aisle of the plane. So Fisher, you know, had his tie on. Seaver grabbed a trainer's scissors, clipped it off right here. Yeah, we checked in the hotel in L.A. He's still wearing his tie. Got off. Yeah, that's Fish. But yeah, he was one of those guys everybody wanted to be around. Yeah. But the knowledge had to be, you know, and you, of course, you come under the influence of so many people, the college guys, your high school guy, and you get to Boston, and then, you know, New York, Toronto, Houston, but somewhere along the line, you're getting advice that doesn't really pertain, or you have to filter out what works for you.
Yeah, I tell the young kids, the minor league guys, the professional guys, you know, keep your eyes and ears open. You're going to hear several things, especially, you know, Cody and all the guys in the minor leagues. He was college player of the year. He gets four bats in, with the Tigers in the minor leagues, and there's a hitting coach that says, you can't hit with a leg kick. He calls me and says, you can't hit with a leg kick. I go, has this guy been watching? There's 500 guys in the majors that have a leg kick. When you ask the question, you know, I was fortunate when I was in high school. I snuck down to Astrodome to watch Nolan Ryan. I got to play with Tom Seaver, who I consider the ultimate power pitcher. I watched him pitching at 42 years of work, at 40 or 42, sitting at about 88 miles an hour. He gets in a jam, 94 strikeout pop up. I go, okay, now I see what's going on here. So it's guys like that. I was a student of the game. When I first got in the majors, I had that little plastic box with those 3x5 index cards. Had all my hitters on. I had the umpires in there too, because we had National League and American League guys. I knew where the umpire's hometown was. If he was from New Hampshire and he's working the plate, I'm pretty sure he's left 8 or 10 tickets for his family to watch him umpire. It works out really nice when he comes out and begins the game and he hands you a ball and I say, Derwood, how are we doing, buddy? Everything's good? Yeah. Derwood's from here, but I would say that to Derwood. I said, how's things going? He goes, thanks for asking, Rock. Doing good. And I said, how's Dorothy? She good? Good. Thanks for asking. Yeah, now the borderline pitch team. So you do that. It went from the index cards to my BlackBerry, and then it went to my iPhone the last 6 years of my career. And Mel Stoudemire, we're going through the pitcher's meeting, and he knows I'm not texting friends or something. I'm actually putting those guys in there. So the next morning when I wake up, you know, whether it be game one or game seven of the World Series or whatever, I'm reviewing these hitters of how I'm going to try and break them down and attack them. I'm going to look for your weakness as quick as I can.
There was a story about Jim Palmer and Earl Weaver, and they were going over the hitters on the other team, scouting the board, and Weaver said, okay, this guy's a great high fastball hitter. Next guy, great high fastball hitter. So on down the line. And Palmer got up. Left. He said, where are you going, Jim? He said, well, I'm a high fastball pitcher, Earl. He said, oh, no, we're not talking about your high fastball.
Yes, I tell the same story all the time when I'm in meetings, and they say, this guy's a first ball fastball hitter. First ball. And I'm on a team with El Duque, David Wells, David Cohen, who all throw frisbees in there, usually for strike one. And And they you know, I go over to the Yankees, next thing you know, my curveball's my fourth best pitch, and they're trying to throw ball one. Then he calls split, and I miss it out of the zone like it's supposed to, and then I'm 2-0 on everybody's. So I had to sit down with the catchers, and there's going to be a documentary coming out I did with Greg Maddux. And Maddux, was, I thought was really cool what he said, is that even though I can, you know, he's a power pitcher, even though he throws 88, I pitched over, I threw balls over 100 miles an hour, but I pitched 95, 97. And when they started interleague play, Maddux said he went and pulled up my videos of facing these guys because he knew I worked off my fastball. And so that's what you were trying to do. A little different when you got to the National League, you know, your first couple guys aren't going to hurt you. So I would throw what I call my bowling ball. It was a heavy two-seamer in the middle. I don't want to get an 11 pitcher bat with you. Then I'm not getting to the ninth inning or the eighth inning. I know that sounds weird right now. Some guys go four. But
when we return, Roger Clemens talks about changes in pitching and the rule changes of today. He also fields questions from the audience and shares more tremendous stories from his career on the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, presented by the Hampton Inn Waco. When you come to Waco, be sure to stay at the Hampton Inn Waco, located just a short distance from the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. You'll start your day off with a delicious complimentary breakfast, and you'll enjoy the Hampton Inn Waco's free Wi-Fi, fitness center, and pool. Next time you bring your team to Waco, make the Hampton Inn Waco your home court on the road. Welcome back to Highlights from the Lone Star Luncheon with guest Roger Clemens on the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, presented by the Hampton Inn Waco.
All right, so now we have openers and guys go one inning, guys go four, as you mentioned, and they're pretty much just throwing as hard as they can. Are we losing the, the pitching is still, there are a lot of great pitchers around now, but are we losing the art of pitching in this process of not having the mentality of I'm going 9 to 9? Yeah, I think you have to tie that in with the pitch clock. The minor league guys are really good that have made it to the majors. They're okay with it because they've been dealing with it. Even some of your veteran pitchers that I've watched and talked or text, the biggest thing I was telling them, you know, you're a power pitcher, you're turning into a power thrower because you're hearing this fastball away in your head and you just grab it and heave it. You have no process of what you're trying to do, especially if you happen to get to the lineup for a third time. You'll never make it through that lineup time because you're just throwing. Now, they pitch it east and west. I love the top of the zone strike. I would love that even more because I featured the ball up there and then I would go down with my split to change your eye level. So, but a lot of them are just grabbing the ball and heaving it with no purpose. And so that's where, and they have the stuff to do that. Now your relievers, everybody in the back end, most teams in the majors, their back end, the bullpen guys are all throwing 100 miles an hour. Your relievers, the mechanics really don't have to be that good. We've got some guys that they look like they're pitching because they're coming at you with elbows and knees and legs and hips. They look like a blender with the lid off of it. They're coming after you. Right, it's going everywhere. Yeah. But if you can stretch them out to 15, 20 pitches, you might run into one. And especially if they have to pitch back-to-back nights when you get to the playoffs, when you see a guy like that. So that's the biggest thing about the rule changes that I've noticed that guys do with that pitch clock. You know, some of them use it to their advantage, but some of them are just grabbing a ball and once the catcher calls it, they throw it.
I was watching Scherzer earlier this season. I know you. Would have done this too. The best players use rule changes, things like that, to their advantage. They figured out very, and he would freeze a hitter. Yeah, it's just a way of working that clock, isn't it? Do you like that?
Yeah, I told Baggy's a great friend, and I told Baggy when I faced him, his wide stance, he's basically doing a squat. So I'm going to hold it as long as I can. His thighs are going to start burning. He's going to have to call timeout, or he's going to have his swing's going to be underwater. So I'm going to hold it on somebody like that. Said the same thing to Cody. Cody gets ready and he's in a flex position, and there's been some pitchers that take the clock all the way down. have about 3 seconds on him. So you're going to have to call timeout because he'll feel like you're in quicksand, that you're stuck. And that's what you want. That's, you know, again, that's the timing part of it that you're trying to, especially when I'm facing a guy like, over my career, Cal Ripken, say. I mean, I faced Ripken 120 times. There's not one pitch that I have that he's not seen. There's not one batting stance that he has. So it's really a game within a game. I mean, it's a man on third, one out. I know he's trying to, so I'm featuring. He knows I'm sinking it. So now the catcher said, watching him. He's going to spread out now because he knows he's going to try and hit it. You know, so you have to just pay attention to the detail.
You always work quickly. And in fact, I remember you even mouthing some pitches to the catcher when the hitter wasn't looking. And I thought, wow, this is something else. But it works. And what, do you like the speed-up rules now?
Yeah, I would have been fine with it. I called 95% of my game from the mound, and it was just with my looks, when the foul ball or the guy's doing his batting gloves. And the only time I had to be careful was when a catcher got traded to another team and they come in, then all bets are off. I mean, I think we got it one time, early, mid to late 80s, no one would show his teeth when he wanted to throw his changeup. So you had to watch him. The guys are still looking down and everyone else started watching, so you had to really do it. I would do a number of things. I would kind of hitch my pants, or if I wanted to repeat that pitch, I would just give him a quick nod. But usually with my looks where I'm looking, he knew which side of the plate I want, and that would dictate fastball or slide for the most part. Straight down the barrel was curveball or split because I'm trying to throw him pretty much down the middle. So it was a great deal. We were working great. Austin's loved it. All the guys loved it. And we were in sync pretty much the whole way. Now, back in the day, when we thought guys on second were messing around with pitches, in a crucial spot, that's when I would call Austin's out or Morgan Posada out and would say, hey, I'm going slider, adding front door slider, which is like a cutter, and then no matter what, I'm finishing with a split. So no signs. So you do two things. You go back there, and he turn around, hit his glove twice, and go, come on. Hitter is all of a sudden called timeout because he's not getting anything from the guy second. So now we got a problem. Now we know something's going on.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I do like the way the game is moving along, but have we solved all the problems now? You think the next generation Z is going to be cool with baseball now?
The biggest problem for you and I, because we're doing TV, we can't tell any stories.
Yeah, do it.
Got a speed tell. So yeah, I think the only one I don't like is the disengagement. That's a little bit. And when you're changing all these rules, why is the foul ball still called a foul ball when you hit it? It's fair. Let's change that. Everybody put that in your complaint box.
Never figured that one out.
It's a fair ball.
Roger Clemens was a hero in Boston, and he loved pitching for the Red Sox. After 13 seasons in Boston, he ended up with the Toronto Blue Jays for 2 seasons. He later pitched for the Yankees and Astros. At the Lone Star Luncheon, Clemens gave the backstory as to why he didn't finish his career in Boston.
Everybody thought you were going to be a Red Sox for life, yeah. Right? So did it revitalize your career to go to Toronto then after that? I don't think so, because you were going to have the same work ethic no matter where you were.
Yeah, I mean, my second to last start, I tied my major league record. I struck out 22 starts before the end of my contract. I was in the top 5 of all pitching categories. But yeah, I was going to sign a 4-year deal at less money. I was going to go into doing something else, who knows what. But I was feeling pretty good about that. But at the time, the general manager came in. He actually sent 5 of us packing. One of them, Mike Remo, he had the best swing on the team at the time. But he wanted his own team. I mean, he wished me well in the twilight of my career. It's happened to go another 12 years, so it was a good twilight. he told the assistant GM who would run with me in between my starts. We had a nice little 3-mile running spot on the water in Boston. Everybody runs in Boston, so it's easy to get out there and find a companion to run with. But I would be doing my distance running in between starts, and Augie's kind of feeling me out, so he's kind of like KGB. I said, oh, I see what you're trying to do. I said, well, just tell him this is what I'm looking to do, and this is what he's going to get. And he aired out Duquette, and aired out Augie. Said, you don't give a 32-year-old pitcher a 3-year deal at 32 years of age. I go, no, you're right. You give him a 10-year deal. That's what they're getting right now. You're right.
Woo.
So, but it was the best thing. You got to understand in Boston, really, the Yankees really weren't our rivals. They had Donnie Mattingly. They had a few good players, but they were terrible. They're a terrible team. And the team that we battled with was the Blue Jays, late 80s, early 90s. They won back-to-back titles. Once I went over to New York, George flew down to Houston twice. The second time, he's like, I've been here twice. Do you want to be a Yankee or don't you? But once I went to New York, we got competitive. Ownership changed in Boston. They bounced their team up. Then the rivalry came back. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're fighting for two teams, one trophy, you're going to knock some heads.
How was Steinbrenner for you?
He was great. A little more mellow than when Reggie had him, you know. But he was still funny. I'd always smile at him, and he would yell at me. He goes, "Why are you smiling at me?" I go, "I love you, boss." You know. But he was the type of owner. I mean, you want to play for a guy. If he had $5 in his pocket, and the guy that made our team better was 10, he's going to find a way to get it. And he would come in on two or three game losing streaks, and I would be pitching that night, and I'm sitting there doing my little 5-pound cuff weights in the trainer's room, and I could see him coming in his penny loafers and his white turtleneck and his jacket, and I looked at him and said, "Hey," I always called him boss. "Hey, boss, I brought you here for a reason." I go, "I got you tonight, I got you." He'd walk back out, and he'd yell at me.
Owners are a different breed, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
So, Drayton certainly pursued you.
Yeah, well, speaking of Waco, I want everybody in this room to get a petition, send Drayton. I came home to pitch, I gave him the hometown discount. Then he wanted me to come stay out of retirement, pitch again. I said, "Well, I'm not going to do it for a discount." And then we made him millions. He builds this football. I left him a text the other day. I was running around Waco, seeing a couple buddies or something, and I see the football stadium with the name on it. And I went into the football stadium, I walked everywhere else, I don't see also home of the Rocket anywhere. I made you so much money, you could put my name somewhere in that football stadium.
Baseball is a sport that is known for having a lot of characters and also for generating friendships. Moderator Bill Brown asked Clemens to name some teammates that stood out to him. He also shared a great story about some true Major League legends.
Who are some of the most fun teammates you've ever had?
Man, I've had a bunch. I mean, obviously, dear to my heart is all my catchers. You know, Charlie O'Brien was one of the best. He just, I don't think he just released it, but he had a book come out called Cy Young Catcher. I think he caught 10 or 11 years of Cy Young Award winners.
Wow.
Yeah. And Atlanta was small team, everybody like that. I had some wonderful catchers. Again, paying attention to detail, trusting their hands, being the boys are catchers or whatever, the coaches that are here. We call some guys windshield wipers. You can't have that. You got to really trust your hands and really a professional player. I tell the guys in really from Double A up that if a catcher's asking for a ball on this side of the plate or this side of the plate, you should be able to deliver that ball within a ball and a half. That's your professional, it's what you do. And that's just practicing perfect. I don't need to have a big quality day at work. I need you to be practice perfect and understand what you're doing. But teammates, just some characters. You know, we had playing with Oil Can Boy. Oil Can was the next closest thing to Mark Fidrich. You know, Cam would talk to the baseball out there. And he just had some good stories. Just watching him work, but I had some great, you know, again, coming up as a rookie, I got broken in by, you know, Jim Rice took me under his wing, told me everything, how I'm supposed to act, to where, to what I'm supposed to dip the clubhouse guy. And Dwight Evans was the same way. Bruce Hershey was great too, so I was pretty lucky to have some great veterans when I got up there. And all the way through, I mean, the history, I mean, I remember one spring training, I pitched three innings in spring training. I went to the back room to drop off my jersey, my wet stuff, at a round table there, just about this size. We were playing the Yankees. They were in Fort Lauderdale back then or something like that. And Red Sox Yankees in Fort Myers, where our first complex was at. And I go back to the washer and dryer and I look over and it's absolute who's who. There's like five or six guys sitting at the table playing cards. And it's Ted Williams, Dom DiMaggio with Red Sox, hit the other DiMaggio, Joe, Big Joe was sitting there, Mantle, Johnny Pesky. And I don't even, I'm like the Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz, shaking my head. And Ted's big booming voice, this was 86. So I just came off my big year with the Sox. So it was 80, beginning of 87, I think. That spring training. And Ted's like, hey, kid. And I'm like, yes, sir. I'm like, yes, sir, no, sir, to him. He goes, let me tell you something. We watched you pitch there in between dealing cards and mantles right there. He goes, you got a chance in this game, but if you had to pitch me, what would you throw me? And Ted Williams is asking, I'm like, I have marbles in my mouth. And I'm like, And then he goes, kid, I would look for your slider. You know why, son? I go, no, sir, Mr. Williams. He goes, because I can hit your damn fastball. Yes, sir, Mr. Williams, I ran out of that. Fast forward to the next year, I went back to backside, so now I'm feeling pretty good. I got a nickname, and I'm Ted, Mickey, you know, there's some other guys there, not the same group, but pretty close. And Ted said the same thing. You remember what I asked you last year, Rocket? I go, yes, sir, Ted, I remember. I said you would look for my slider because you could hit my fastball. He goes, yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. I go, I got this thing called a split finger now, Ted. He goes, no, that's cheating. That's cheating.
Clemens also spoke about what he's doing today.
So where are you now? Have you just put all this in the rearview mirror and you're plowing ahead, your foundation and other things? You're very, very busy right now.
Yeah, I'm busy, and like I tell people, I did it for 24 years. I loved it. Like I told you, a lot of respect for the teams I played for, work ethic, everything else. But I tell people, that's what I did. It's not who I am as a person. And, you know, like I said, we had the foundation for, we just celebrated our 30th year. We help at-risk children. We do some really fun auction item stuff. And so this was great when I heard from the guys that come. Wanted to have this little chat. This is always great to come back somewhere that honored you and you get to see some cool stuff. But yeah, just familiar faces. I mean, this is home for me. When the other teams, the Yankees, Blue Jays, Red Sox asked me to call or talk to one of their pitchers, I do it. Still love working with the guys here in Houston. Again, so much fun for me to come home for 3 years, play, sleep in my own bed, play alongside guys that I've watched for a long time. Get to the World Series. I mean, we flipped a football town for those 3 years. I mean, it was, we didn't have an empty seat in that stadium, and it was rocking. And, but yeah, just, this, you know, the stuff that I enjoy doing. We've got plenty of golf events. I've got plenty investments that we keep checking up on, and just enjoying it. You know, got the grandbabies. I'm poppy rocking now. I do probably, I don't know, something's been out there a little bit, but I do some DJing at night. DJ No Request is my official name. I play what I want, even if you request it. Just enjoying chasing Cody now, too. Cody's getting a little taste of it. He actually texted me when he talked about 24 years. It was funny, he goes, 2 days ago, he goes, Dad, I'm coming up on 1 year of service time. How the heck did you do this for 24? And I said, you grind it out, baby. So you gotta love what you do. And so hopefully he'll get some more bats and get in there, and the Phillies will get going.
Clemens was also asked to share the story about the Astros' famous 18-inning playoff game against Atlanta during the 2005 National League Division Series. The Rocket came into the game during the 16th inning and gave up only one hit over three innings. Clemens was credited with the victory, and the win placed Houston in the National League Championship Series en route to the franchise's first ever World Series appearance. Moderator Bill Brown prefaced the story by calling it one of the best in Astros history.
So we were together last year at that event in a main park. This is one of the best stories in Astros history. And as you know, 2005, playoff game, Atlanta, 18 innings. Anybody remember that one?
Yeah.
And I'm going to let you take it from there.
That's similar to the 20 strikeout game, real close actually. Those are probably my two craziest ones. So playing the Braves. I'm scheduled to go, I think, game five, Pettit's. If we lose, we go to Atlanta, and Pettit's supposed to pitch. But anyway, it's like a 12 o'clock game. My youngest one is in a Pop Warner football game, playoff game, which worked out perfectly because we didn't have to report we weren't going to hit on the field. They were painting the logos on the field, or something's going on. So we're hitting in the cages. You warm up on your own, kind of almost like a show and go. And so I roll in there about 20 minutes. I've done all my work, did all my running at the house, everything I needed to do. Go to the game. I watch a halftime of the little guys that I got to get to the stadium playoff game. Get to the stadium. Haven't touched the ball, thrown the ball, how I feel. I see Hickey, our rookie pitching coach, and I say, Hick, what's up? Where's Pettit? He goes, Wes, I need to talk to you. He goes, Pettit's at home, can't get his head off the pillow, he's got the flu. He goes, how do you feel? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, thinking about, you know, we go to Atlanta, you're up. I go, okay, well, I can't tell you how I feel because I ain't touched the ball. We never, you know, we just was showing him. He goes, you need to find out how you feel. And Phil Garner's in the dugout, he's listening to the whole thing. Now, I've got a jacket on with the Astros t-shirt underneath. They lock up my jerseys. For some reason, my jerseys disappear on the road and everywhere else with these clubhouse guys. And so they lock both of my game jerseys up, and so I got a t-shirt on. And I go, okay, well, I'll figure what's up. Well, I got everybody in the suite. Kobe's my oldest one. He's getting ready to get drafted by the Astros. He's a senior in high school. I call up to the suite, get Kobe, and go, what are you doing? It's the third inning of this game, close game with Atlanta. So get down here. I said, meet me in the back of the cage. I got to play catch, and I need you to catch me. Everybody else is on the field. Game's going on. What's going on, Bob? I go, I might be pitching tomorrow in Atlanta. I don't know what. He goes, can I bring my buddy Blake with me? He's number two. I said, yeah, bring him down, whatever you got to do. Get in the cage in the far back of the stadium underneath, and I start playing catch with Kobe. And I throw about 15 pitches, about 70 miles an hour. My shoulder feels good. I'm good. There's two bats sitting right there. Kobe goes, hey, Dad, throw me a couple. I'm going to hit the same thing. I hit the cage here. All right. I throw like two, and he laces them both. And the second one is a bomb, and he flips the bat on Dad. I go, wait a minute. Hold up. Hold up. Get back in the box. Now, full length, you know, 60 feet, 6 inches, and we start going at each other. And before I blink, I've thrown 55 pitches, 90 miles an hour. I'm soaked. My shirt's soaked. I said, y'all get out of here. And they go up. I walk through the weight room. The strength coach sees me. He's like, what did it look like I went through a car wash? Where the hell have you been? I go, I'm fine. I was just trying to stretch out and get loose. Blow him off. Get through the trainer's room. Trainer's like, what the hell are you? I go, nah, I'm good. Put my jacket back. I go to the tunnel. I tell Hick. I go like this. Give him a thumbs up. He's like, I'm sweating. Sweating. Garner's like, work. What are you doing? I go, I just played a little catch. Don't worry. No big deal. Like that. Now, fast forward. This game starts happening. Next thing you know, is it Osmus hit the granny to tie the game up?
He hit a solo homer in the ninth.
Okay, the solo. Yeah. So he hits a solo. Garner's already asked me twice. I got my tennis shoes on. He goes, you need to find your jersey and get your spikes on. I go, because I bunted, obviously, the best on the team. So he's going to use me as a bunt. This game's getting weird. Next thing you know, nothing happens. Now we're in extras. And now we're in the 13th inning, I think it is. And Garner comes and looks at me and goes, where's your jersey? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, no, it's not for bunting. You need to get your spikes on the thing. You may have to get to the bullpen. I go, oh, God. I just threw 9 innings an hour ago. My arm, there's no way I'm pitching a major league game right now. And I go, serious? Boom, next inning, nobody. He goes, you need to go down. I go, well, I'm not walking across the field. Now, the other part of my family, they're watching the game on ESPN, and they see me. I go underneath the tunnel, and I walk out through the door out there where they bring the gear, and I hover real tightly across by the bullpen there at Minute Maid, and I go sit down, and Lidge and Wheeler, I think, are just the only ones left. For sure, Wheeler. And they're like, what are you doing? I go, two things. I haven't eaten all day. I'm starving. Where's that big bag of garbage you guys bring out with candy bars and bananas? And he goes, oh, Rock, we throw that in the stands after the third inning. So I said, get all the clubhouse kid to bring me two bananas and a Powerade. Now I'm sitting out there and I'm looking at the lineup. Now we're in the 15th. Wheeler's gone. There goes Danny. I'm sitting out there by myself with a bullpen coach. I'm going to get in this game. This is going to be crazy. And so I eat the bananas. Gardner calls down, and I tell Phil, I told our bullpen coach, call him back because Wheeler's spot is coming up, and I'll bunt for him. He's never bunted. He's a reliever. He won't get it down. Get me in the game.
and Garner gets on the phone. You just worry about getting ready. I might have to use you on the mound. You get ready. Hangs up to me. Now his lineup card looks like a 3-year-old with Crayolas on it. There's marks everywhere. And he realized what I was talking about. Phone, barely hung up. Phone rings again. He goes, he's right. Get him in here. Right before that, the bullpen coach said, you need to get up and throw. I go, I feel pretty good. I really don't. But he goes, no, you need to. So I get up there and I throw like 6 pitches, about 50 miles an hour. And he's on the phone telling Hickey, he's like, oh God, this is going to be a disaster. He can't even, he barely even throw. So I lob, I run in there, I get the bunt down. And but the family seen it on ESPN, seen me sitting in the bullpen, they were freaking out. I get out there and it just came to life and the lights got bright, man. And I pitched 3 scoreless and we would still be playing. If Chris Burke didn't hit that home run, we'd still be there. So that's how it went.
Audience members were also given the opportunity to ask Roger Clemens questions. One asked about what it was like to return to Fenway Park in the visiting dugout after pitching for the Red Sox for so long.
Well, the first time back was with the Blue Jays. That was my first one. And my catcher, Charlie O'Brien, he usually walks shoulder to shoulder with me to every bullpen on the road. And we came out of the dugout at Fenway on the opposite side, and he was about where you were at, walking to the bullpen. And I go, hey, what are you doing here? I'm not standing next to you on this walk going out there. And Charlie said it was one of the most electric games that they were pitching. It was weird. It was the first time that I had to face some of my old team, you know, Mo Vaughn, John Valentin, some guys like that. So it was a little different, but you know, you just pretty much just lock back in. New York's you know, same way. I mean, it's the same thing when you're in those stadiums. Like Derek Jeter and I always told it, and I told my boys, they don't boo nobodies. You know, you walk out, Derek and I walk out of the dugout. They come to the hardest place, the pitch, as far as people getting on you, is Comiskey, White Sox, warming up out there. That I remember one game I was warming up, Mel Stottlemyre got a chuck because some guy was, there's like 6 college drunk football players right on the railing just wearing me out. The only peace and quiet I got was when the anthem played. They had to shut up for 2 minutes.
He was also asked who were the toughest players for him to pitch against.
I just talked about it earlier. I think when I came to the Astros, we were in the National League, and the contact guys are the toughest. I don't want to get in a 11-pitch at bat. I want to get you out of there within 4 or 5 pitches. Probably throw something conducive down in the zone to get you out of there because they don't strike out that much. Then you have to worry about a 3, 4, 5 hitter. But like, you know, Pujols would always say that, you know, I would always give him one good pitch to hit, and if he missed it, I got him. The home run guys, they're swinging obviously a little higher rate of speed, so you have to make a mistake or two to get those guys. But fun for me, I tell the story all the time. Reggie was just at my house the other day. He's doing some work for the Astros, and I wanted to get to the major leagues to face Reggie Jackson. And so when I did, I was at Fenway Park, third or fourth start of the season, and our big announcer, Sherm Feller, big booming voice, now batting for the California Angels, number 44, Reggie Jackson. And I'm like, I was behind the mound. My shoes weren't untied, but I was untying and retying because I didn't want to turn around and make eye contact with him. And then I turn around, there he is with his half-shell helmet, his glasses. I tell the story all the time. Punched him out 3 times, first 3 times. Last one, he hit a 2-run homer in the bullpen. There he goes. I was almost happy that he hit the homer. But so that was fun, you know, having the opportunity to meet Koufax, go on Don Drysdale's radio show a couple times with him. There's, you know, some great ones that, you know, again, I was fortunate to pitch as long as I did. You know, you go come right out of the University of Texas. I'm at Fenway Park, and I'm pitching against Don Baylor and Carlton Fisk and Dave Kingman, Greg Luzinski. I mean, it's pretty cool when you think back at those guys that paved the way for us.
The Lone Star Luncheon concluded with an audience member asking Roger Clemens if he had a favorite ballpark in which to pitch.
The best stadium by far probably still is. It gets rated for y'all. It gets rated the best food every year in and year out. And I'm not kidding you, the infield and outfield grass, you can throw your turkey sandwich in the grass and pick it up and eat it. It's perfect. It's Anaheim, where the Angels play. The weather's always perfect. Stadium's really, really good.
Speaking on stadiums, there were some the little things that I try and tell the pitchers these days too, because most of the stadium guys will do it, is when I was at Fenway, another little thing to help me concentrate and help my mechanics when I was young, working on my mechanics. The width of a lawnmower when they mow it is about the width of a major league pitcher's plate, about 17 inches, maybe a little bit bigger. I told the guy at Fenway, Yankee Stadium, Toronto was easy because they had a seam actually running right down Broadway. And then here in Houston, the last mow job would be right down Broadway. So when I was on the mound, it's like I'm a bowler. I got a lane and I know right where I'm going. I'll maybe make quick adjustments on the run. No different than when I'm playing golf and I hit a slice, I'm hitting the slice, I'm getting my brain speed out, go to the right side of the tee box, just play it the rest of the day, go to the range and fix it. There's constant making in-game adjustments to stay alive. Good? Thanks for being here, y'all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, presented by the Hampton Inn Waco. We invite you to visit the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, and when you do, book your stay at the Hampton Inn Waco. Learn about future events at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame by visiting the Hall of Fame's official website, tshof.org. You can also follow the Texas Sports Hall of Fame's social media channels on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast and give it a great review wherever you listen to podcasts.